The Portrait of a Lady, Volume 2. Chapter 28. On the morrow, in the evening, Lord Warburton went again to see his friends at their hotel, and at this establishment he learned that they had gone to the opera. He drove to the opera with the idea of paying them a visit in their box after the easy Italian fashion, and when he had obtained his admittance it was one of the secondary theaters looked about the large, bare, ill-lighted house. An act had just terminated and he was at liberty to pursue his quest. After scanning two or three tiers of boxes he perceived in one of the largest of these receptacles a lady whom he easily recognized. Miss Archer was seated facing the stage and partly screened by the curtain of the box, and beside her, leaning back in his chair, was Mr. Gilbert Osmond. They appeared to have the place to themselves, and Warburton supposed their companions had taken advantage of the recess to enjoy the relative coolness of the lobby. He stood a while with his eyes on the interesting pair. He asked himself if he should go up and interrupt the harmony. At last he judged that Isabel had seen him, and this accident determined him. There should be no marked holding off. He took his way to the upper regions and on the staircase met Ralph Tudgett slowly descending, his hat at the inclination of ennui and his hands where they usually were. "I saw you below a moment since and was going down to you. I feel lonely and want company," was Ralph's greeting. "You've some that's very good which you've yet deserted. Do you mean my cousin? Oh, she has a visitor and doesn't want me." "Then Miss Stackpole and Bantling have gone out to a cafe to eat an ice." Miss Stackpole delights in an ice. "I didn't think they wanted me either. The opera's very bad, the women look like laundresses and sing like peacocks. I feel very low." "You had better go home," Lord Warburton said without affectation. "And leave my young lady in this sad place? Ah no, I must watch over her. She seems to have plenty of friends." "Yes, that's why I must watch," said Ralph with the same large mock melancholy. "If she doesn't want you it's probable she doesn't want me." "No, you're different. Go to the box and stay there while I walk about." Lord Warburton went to the box, where Isabel's welcome was as to a friend so honorably old that he vaguely asked himself what queer temporal province she was annexing. He exchanged greetings with Mr. Osmond, to whom he had been introduced the day before and who, after he came in, sat blandly apart and silent, as if repudiating competence in the subjects of illusion now probable. It struck her second visitor that Miss Archer had, in operatic conditions, a radiance, even a slight exaltation, as she was, however, at all times a keenly glancing, quickly moving, completely animated young woman. He may have been mistaken on this point. Her talk with him moreover pointed to presence of mind. It expressed a kindness so ingenious and deliberate as to indicate that she was in undisturbed possession of her faculties. Poor Lord Warburton had moments of bewilderment. She had discouraged him, formally, as much as a woman could. What business had she then with such arts and such felicities, above all with such tones of reparation? Her voice had tricks of sweetness, but why play them on him? The others came back, the bare, familiar, trivial opera began again. The box was large, and there was room for him to remain if he would sit a little behind and in the dark. He did so for half an hour, while Mr. Osmond remained in front, leaning forward, his elbows on his knees, just behind Isabel. Lord Warburton heard nothing, and from his gloomy corner saw nothing but the clear profile of this young lady defined against the dim illumination of the house. When there was another interval no one moved. Mr. Osmond talked to Isabel, and Lord Warburton kept his corner. He did so but for a short time, however, after which he got up and bade goodnight to the ladies. Isabel said nothing to detain him, but it didn't prevent his being puzzled again. Why should she mark so one of his values quite the wrong one when she would have nothing to do with another, which was quite the right? He was angry with himself for being puzzled, and then angry for being angry. Bertie's music did little to comfort him, and he left the theater and walked homeward, without knowing his way, through the tortuous, tragic streets of Rome, where heavier sorrows than his had been carried under the stars. "What's the character of that gentleman?" Osmond asked of Isabel after he had retired. "Irreproachable, don't you see it? He owns about half England, that's his character," Henrietta remarked. "That's what they call a free country." "Ah, he's a great proprietor? Happy man," said Gilbert Osmond. "Do you call that happiness, the ownership of wretched human beings?" cried Miss Stackpole. "He owns his tenants and has thousands of them. It's pleasant to own something, but inanimate objects are enough for me. I don't insist on flesh and blood and minds and consciences." "It seems to me you own a human being or two," Mr. Bantling suggested jocosely. "I wonder if Warburton orders his tenants about as you do me." Lord Warburton's a great radical, Isabel said. He has very advanced opinions. He has very advanced stone walls. His park's enclosed by a gigantic iron fence, some 30 miles round, Henrietta announced for the information of Mr. Osmond. I should like him to converse with a few of our Boston radicals. Don't they approve of iron fences? Asked Mr. Bantling. Only to shut up wicked conservatives. I always feel as if I were talking to you over something with a neat top finish of broken glass. Do you know him well, this unreformed reformer? Osmond went on, questioning Isabel. Well enough for all the use I have for him. And how much of a use is that? Well, I like to like him. Liking to like, why, it makes a passion, said Osmond. No, she considered, keep that for liking to dislike. Do you wish to provoke me then, Osmond laughed, to a passion for him? She said nothing for a moment, but then met the light question with a disproportionate gravity. No, Mr. Osmond, I don't think I should ever dare to provoke you. Lord Warburton, at any rate, she more easily added, is a very nice man. Of great ability? Her friend inquired. Of excellent ability, and as good as he looks. As good as he's good-looking, do you mean? He's very good-looking. How detestably fortunate. To be a great English magnate, to be clever and handsome into the bargain, and, by way of finishing off, to enjoy your high favor. That's a man I could envy. Isabel considered him with interest. You seem to me to be always envying someone. Yesterday it was the Pope, today it's poor Lord Warburton. My envy's not dangerous, it wouldn't hurt a mouse. I don't want to destroy the people, I only want to be them. You see, it would destroy only myself. You'd like to be the Pope? Said Isabel. I should love it, but I should have gone in for it earlier. But why, Osmond reverted, do you speak of your friend as poor? Women, when they are very, very good, sometimes pity men after they've hurt them, that's their great way of showing kindness, said Ralph, joining in the conversation for the first time and with a cynicism so transparently ingenious as to be virtually innocent. Pray, have I hurt Lord Warburton? Isabel asked, raising her eyebrows as if the idea were perfectly fresh. It serves him right if you have, said Henrietta while the curtain rose for the ballet. Isabel saw no more of her attributive victim for the next 24 hours, but on the second day after the visit to the opera she encountered him in the gallery of the Capitol, where he stood before the lion of the collection, the statue of the dying gladiator. She had come in with her companions, among whom, on this occasion again, Gilbert Osmond had his place, and the party, having ascended the staircase, entered the first and finest of the rooms. Lord Warburton addressed her alertly enough, but said in a moment that he was leaving the gallery. And I'm leaving Rome, he added. I must bid you goodbye. Isabel, inconsequently enough, was now sorry to hear it. This was perhaps because she had ceased to be afraid of his renewing his suit, she was thinking of something else. She was on the point of naming her regret, but she checked herself and simply wished him a happy journey, which made him look at her rather unlightedly. I'm afraid you'll think me very volatile. I told you the other day I wanted so much to stop. Oh no, you could easily change your mind. That's what I have done. Bon voyage then. You're in a great hurry to get rid of me, said his lordship quite dismally. Not in the least. But I hate partings. You don't care what I do, he went on pitifully. Isabel looked at him a moment. Ah, she said, you're not keeping your promise. He colored like a boy of 15. If I'm not, then it's because I can't, and that's why I'm going. Goodbye then. Goodbye. He lingered still, however. When shall I see you again? Isabel hesitated, but soon, as if she had had a happy inspiration, some day after you're married. That will never be. It will be after you are. That will do as well, she smiled. Yes, quite as well. Goodbye. They shook hands, and he left her alone in the glorious room, among the shining antique marbles. She sat down in the center of the circle of these presences, regarding them vaguely, resting her eyes on their beautiful blank faces, listening, as it were, to their eternal silence. It is impossible, in Rome at least, to look long at a great company of Greek sculptures without feeling the effect of their noble quietude, which, as with a high door closed for the ceremony, slowly drops on the spirit the large white mantle of peace. I say in Rome especially, because the Roman air is an exquisite medium for such impressions. The golden sunshine mingles with them, the deep stillness of the past, so vivid yet, though it is nothing but a void full of names, seems to throw a solemn spell upon them. The blinds were partly closed in the windows of the Capitol, and a clear, Warm shadow rested on the figures and made them more mildly human. Isabel sat there a long time, under the charm of their motionless grace, wondering to what, of their experience, their absent eyes were open, and how, to her ears, their alien lips would sound. The dark red walls of the room threw them into relief, the polished marble floor reflected their beauty. She had seen them all before, but her enjoyment repeated itself, and it was all the greater because she was glad again, for the time, to be alone. At last, however, her attention lapsed, drawn off by a deeper tide of life. An occasional tourist came in, stopped and stared a moment at the dying gladiator, and then passed out of the other door, creaking over the smooth pavement. At the end of half an hour Gilbert Osmond reappeared, apparently in advance of his companions. He strolled toward her slowly, with his hands behind him and his usual inquiring, yet not quite appealing smile. "I'm surprised to find you alone, I thought you had company." "So I had the best." And she glanced at the Antinous and the Faun. "Do you call them better company than an English peer?" "Ah, my English peer left me some time ago." She got up, speaking with intention a little dryly. Mr. Osmond noted her dryness, which contributed for him to the interest of his question. "I'm afraid that what I heard the other evening is true, you're rather cruel to that nobleman." Isabel looked a moment at the vanquished gladiator. "It's not true. I'm scrupulously kind." "That's exactly what I mean," Gilbert Osmond returned, and with such happy hilarity that his joke needs to be explained. "We know that he was fond of originals, of rarities, of the superior and the exquisite, and now that he had seen Lord Warburton, whom he thought a very fine example of his race and order, he perceived a new attraction in the idea of taking to himself a young lady who had qualified herself to figure in his collection of choice objects by declining so noble a hand." Gilbert Osmond had a high appreciation of this particular patriciate, not so much for its distinction, which he thought easily surpassable, as for its solid actuality. He had never forgiven his star for not appointing him to an English dukedom, and he could measure the unexpectedness of such conduct as Isabel's. It would be proper that the woman he might marry should have done something of that sort. Chapter 29. Ralph Touchett, in talk with his excellent friend, had rather markedly qualified, as we know, his recognition of Gilbert Osmond's personal merits, but he might really have felt himself illiberal in the light of that gentleman's conduct during the rest of the visit to Rome. Osmond spent a portion of each day with Isabel and her companions, and ended by affecting them as the easiest of men to live with. Who wouldn't have seen that he could command, as it were, both tact and gaiety? Which perhaps was exactly why Ralph had made his old-time look of superficial sociability a reproach to him. Even Isabel's invidious kinsman was obliged to admit that he was just now a delightful associate. His good humor was imperturbable, his knowledge of the right fact, his production of the right word, as convenient as the friendly flicker of a match for your cigarette. Clearly he was amused as a man could be who was so little ever surprised, and that made him almost applausive. It was not that his spirits were visibly high. He would never, in the concert of pleasure, touch the beak drum by so much as a knuckle. He had a mortal dislike to the high, ragged note, to what he called random ravings. He thought Miss Archer sometimes of too precipitate a readiness. It was pity she had that fault, because if she had not had it she would really have had none. She would have been as smooth to his general need of her as handled ivory to the palm. If he was not personally loud, however, he was deep, and during these closing days of the Roman May he knew a complacency that matched with slow irregular walks under the pines of the Villa Borghese, among the small sweet meadow flowers and the mossy marbles. He was pleased with everything. He had never before been pleased with so many things at once. Old impressions, old enjoyments, renewed themselves. One evening, going home to his room at the inn, he wrote down a little sonnet to which he prefixed the title of Rome Revisited. A day or two later he showed this piece of correct and ingenious verse to Isabel, explaining to her that it was an Italian fashion to commemorate the occasions of life by a tribute to the muse. He took his pleasures in general singly. He was too often he would have admitted that too sorely aware of something wrong, something ugly, the fertilizing dew of a conceivable felicity too seldom descended on his spirit. But at present he was happier than he had perhaps ever been in his life, and the feeling had a large foundation. This was simply the sense of success, the most agreeable emotion of the human heart. Osmond had never had too much of it. In this respect he had the irritation of satiety, as he knew perfectly well and often reminded himself. "Ah no, I've not been spoiled, certainly I've not been spoiled," he used inwardly to repeat. "If I do succeed before I die I shall thoroughly have earned it." He was too apt to reason as if earning this boon consisted above all of covertly aching for it and might be confined to that exercise. Absolutely void of it, also, his career had not been, he might indeed have suggested to a spectator here and there that he was resting on vague laurels. But his triumphs were, some of them, now too old, others had been too easy. The present one had been less arduous than might have been expected, but had been easy that is had been rapid only because he had made an altogether exceptional effort, a greater effort than he had believed it in him to make. The desire to have something or other to show for his parts to show somehow or other had been the dream of his youth, but as the years went on the conditions attached to any marked proof of rarity had affected him more and more as gross and detestable, like the swallowing of mugs of beer to advertise what one could stand. If an anonymous drawing on a museum wall had been conscious and watchful, it might have known this peculiar pleasure of being at last and all of a sudden identified as from the hand of a great master by the so high and so unnoticed fact of style. His style was what the girl had discovered with a little help, and now, beside herself enjoying it, she should publish it to the world without his having any of the trouble. She should do the thing for him, and he would not have waited in vain. Shortly before the time fixed in advance for her departure, this young lady received from Mrs. Touchett a telegram running as follows: "Leave Florence 4th June for Bellagio, and take you if you have not other views. But can't wait if you dawdle in Rome." The dawdling in Rome was very pleasant, but Isabel had different views, and she let her aunt know she would immediately join her. She told Gilbert Osmond that she had done so, and he replied that, spending many of his summers as well as his winters in Italy, he himself would loiter a little longer in the cool shadow of St. Peter's. He would not return to Florence for 10 days more, and in that time she would have started for Bellagio. It might be months in this case before he should see her again. This exchange took place in the large decorated sitting room occupied by our friends at the hotel. It was late in the evening, and Ralph Touchett was to take his cousin back to Florence on the morrow. Osmond had found the girl alone. Miss Stackpole had contracted a friendship with a delightful American family on the fourth floor and had mounted the interminable staircase to pay them a visit. Henrietta contracted friendships, in traveling, with great freedom, and had formed in railway carriages several that were among her most valued ties. Ralph was making arrangements for the morrow's journey, and Isabel sat alone in a wilderness of yellow upholstery. The chairs and sofas were orange, the walls and windows were draped in purple and gilt. The mirrors, the pictures had great flamboyant frames, the ceiling was deeply vaulted and painted over with naked muses and cherubs. For Osmond the place was ugly to distress, the false colors, the sham splendor were like vulgar, bragging, lying talk. Isabel had taken in hand a volume of Ampere, presented, on their arrival in Rome, by Ralph, but though she held it in her lap with her finger vaguely kept in the place, she was not impatient to pursue her study. A lamp covered with a drooping veil of pink tissue paper burned on the table beside her and diffused a strange pale rosiness over the scene. "You say you'll come back, but who knows?" Gilbert Osmond said. "I think you're much more likely to start on your voyage round the world. You're under no obligation to come back, you can do exactly what you choose, you can roam through space." "Well, Italy's a part of space," Isabel answered. "I can take it on the way." "On the way round the world?" "No, don't do that. Don't put us in a parenthesis, give us a chapter to ourselves. I don't want to see you on your travels. I'd rather see you when they're over." "I should like to see you when you're tired and satiated," Osmond added in a moment. "I shall prefer you in that state." Isabel, with her eyes bent, fingered the pages of M. Ampere. "You turn things into ridicule without seeming to do it, though not, I think, without intending it. You've no respect for my travels, you think them ridiculous. Where do you find that?" She went on in the same tone, fretting the edge of her book with the paper knife. "You see my ignorance, my blunders, the way I wander about as if the world belonged to me, simply because it has been put into my power to do so. You don't think a woman ought to do that. You think it bold and ungraceful." "I think it beautiful," said Osmond. "You know my opinions, I've treated you to enough of them. Don't you remember my telling you that one ought to make one's life a work of art? You looked rather shocked at first. But then I told you that it was exactly what you seemed to me to be trying to do with your own." She looked up from her book. "What you despise most in the world is bad, is stupid art." "Possibly. But yours seemed to me very clear and very good." "If I were to go to Japan next winter, you would laugh at me," she went on. Osmond gave a smile, a keen one, but not a laugh, for the tone of their conversation was not jocose. Isabel had in fact her solemnity, he had seen it before. "You have one." "That's exactly what I say. You think such an idea absurd." I would give my little finger to go to Japan, it's one of the countries I want most to see. Can't you believe that, with my taste for old lacquer? I haven't a taste for old lacquer to excuse me, said Isabel. You've a better excuse the means of going. You're quite wrong in your theory that I laugh at you. I don't know what has put it into your head. It wouldn't be remarkable if you did think it ridiculous that I should have the means to travel when you've not, for you know everything and I know nothing. The more reason why you should travel and learn, smiled Osmond. Besides, he added as if it were a point to be made, I don't know everything. Isabel was not struck with the oddity of his saying this gravely. She was thinking that the pleasantest incident of her life, so it pleased her to qualify these two few days in Rome, which she might musingly have likened to the figure of some small princess of one of the ages of dress over muffled in a mantle of state and dragging a train, that it took pages or historians to hold up that this felicity was coming to an end. That most of the interest of the time had been owing to Mr. Osmond was a reflection she was not just now at pains to make. She had already done the point abundant justice. But she said to herself that if there were a danger they should never meet again, perhaps after all it would be as well. Happy things don't repeat themselves, and her adventure wore already the changed, the seaward face of some romantic island from which, after feasting on purple grapes, she was putting off while the breeze rose. She might come back to Italy and find him different, the strange man who pleased her just as he was, and it would be better not to come than run the risk of that. But if she was not to come, the greater the pity that the chapter was closed. She felt for a moment a pang that touched the source of tears. The sensation kept her silent, and Gilbert Osmond was silent too. He was looking at her. Go everywhere, he said at last, in a low, kind voice, do everything, get everything out of life. Be happy, be triumphant. What do you mean by being triumphant? Well, doing what you like. To triumph, then, it seems to me, is to fail. Doing all the vain things one likes is often very tiresome. Exactly, said Osmond with his quiet quickness. As I intimated just now, you'll be tired someday. He paused a moment and then he went on, I don't know whether I had better not wait till then for something I want to say to you. I can't advise you without knowing what it is. But I'm horrid when I'm tired, Isabel added with due inconsequence. I don't believe that. You're angry, sometimes that I can believe, though I've never seen it. But I'm sure you're never cross. Not even when I lose my temper? You don't lose it, you find it, and that must be beautiful. Osmond spoke with a noble earnestness. They must be great moments to see. If I could only find it now. Isabel nervously cried. I'm not afraid, I should fold my arms and admire you. I'm speaking very seriously. He leaned forward, a hand on each knee. For some moments he bent his eyes on the floor. What I wish to say to you, he went on at last, looking up, is that I find I'm in love with you. She instantly rose. Ah, keep that till I am tired. Tired of hearing it from others? He sat there raising his eyes to her. No, you may heed it now or never, as you please. But after all I must say it now. She had turned away, but in the movement she had stopped herself and dropped her gaze upon him. The two remained a while in this situation, exchanging a long look, the large, conscious look of the critical hours of life. Then he got up and came near her. Deeply respectful, as if he were afraid he had been too familiar. I'm absolutely in love with you. He had repeated the announcement in a tone of almost impersonal discretion, like a man who expected very little from it but who spoke for his own needed relief. The tears came into her eyes, this time they obeyed the sharpness of the pang that suggested to her somehow the slipping of a fine bolt backward, forward, she couldn't have said which. The words he had uttered made him, as he stood there, beautiful and generous, invested him as with a golden air of early autumn, but, morally speaking, she retreated before them, facing him still as she had retreated in the other cases before a like encounter. Oh, don't say that, please, she answered with an intensity that expressed the dread of having, in this case too, to choose and decide. What made her dread great was precisely the force which, as it would seem, ought to have banished all dread, the sense of something within herself, deep down, that she supposed to be inspired in trustful passion. It was there like a large sum stored in a bank which there was a terror in having to begin to spend. If she touched it, it would all come out. I haven't the idea that it will matter much to you, said Osmond. I've too little to offer you. What I have, it's enough for me, but it's not enough for you. I've neither fortune, nor fame, nor extrinsic advantages of any kind. So I offer nothing. I only tell you because I think it can't offend you, and some day or other it may give you pleasure. It gives me pleasure, I assure you. He went on, standing there before her, considerately inclined to her, turning his hat, which he had taken up, slowly round with a movement which had all the decent tremor of awkwardness and none of its oddity, and presenting to her his firm, refined, slightly ravaged face. "It gives me no pain, because it's perfectly simple. For me you'll always be the most important woman in the world." Isabel looked at herself in this character, looked intently, thinking she filled it with a certain grace. But what she said was not an expression of any such complacency. "You don't offend me, but you ought to remember that, without being offended, one may be incommoded, troubled." Incommoded, she heard herself saying that, and it struck her as a ridiculous word. But it was what stupidly came to her. "I remember perfectly. Of course you're surprised and startled. But if it's nothing but that, it will pass away. And it will perhaps leave something that I may not be ashamed of." "I don't know what it may leave. You see at all events that I'm not overwhelmed," said Isabel with rather a pale smile. "I'm not too troubled to think. And I think that I'm glad I leave Rome tomorrow. Of course I don't agree with you there. I don't at all know you," she added abruptly, and then she colored as she heard herself saying what she had said almost a year before to Lord Warburton. "If you were not going away you'd know me better." "I shall do that some other time." "I hope so. I'm very easy to know." "No, no," she emphatically answered, "there you're not sincere. You're not easy to know, no one could be less so." "Well," he laughed, "I said that because I know myself. It may be a boast, but I do." "Very likely, but you're very wise."
"So are you, Miss Archer," Osmond exclaimed.
"I don't feel so just now. Still, I'm wise enough to think you had better go. Good night."
"God bless you," said Gilbert Osmond, taking the hand which she failed to surrender. After which he added, "If we meet again you'll find me as you leave me. If we don't I shall be so all the same."
"Thank you very much. Goodbye." There was something quietly firm about Isabel's visitor. He might go of his own movement, but wouldn't be dismissed.
"There's one thing more. I haven't asked anything of you, not even a thought in the future, you must do me that justice. But there's a little service I should like to ask. I shall not return home for several days. Rome's delightful, and it's a good place for a man in my state of mind.
Oh, I know you're sorry to leave it, but you're right to do what your aunt wishes."
"She doesn't even wish it," Isabel broke out strangely. Osmond was apparently on the point of saying something that would match these words, but he changed his mind and rejoined simply, "Ah well, it's proper you should go with her, very proper. Do everything that's proper, I go in for that. Excuse my being so patronizing. You say you don't know me, but when you do you'll discover what a worship I have for propriety."
"You're not conventional?" Isabel gravely asked.
"I like the way you utter that word. No, I'm not conventional, I'm convention itself. You don't understand that?" And he paused a moment, smiling.
"I should like to explain it." Then with a sudden, quick, bright naturalness, "Do come back again," he pleaded. "There are so many things we might talk about."
She stood there with lowered eyes. "What service did you speak of just now?"
"Go and see my little daughter before you leave Florence. She's alone at the villa. I decided not to send her to my sister, who hasn't at all my ideas."
"Tell her she must love her poor father very much," said Gilbert Osmond gently.
"It will be a great pleasure to me to go," Isabel answered. "I'll tell her what you say. Once more goodbye."
On this he took a rapid, respectful leave. When he had gone she stood a moment looking about her and seated herself slowly and with an air of deliberation. She sat there till her companions came back, with folded hands, gazing at the ugly carpet. Her agitation, for it had not diminished, was very still, very deep. What had happened was something that for a week past her imagination had been going forward to meet, but here, when it came, she stopped. That sublime principle somehow broke down. The working of this young lady's spirit was strange, and I can only give it to you as I see it, not hoping to make it seem altogether natural. Her imagination, as I say, now hung back. There was a last vague space it couldn't cross, a dusky, uncertain tract which looked ambiguous and even slightly treacherous, like a moorland scene in the winter twilight. But she was to cross it yet.
Chapter 30. She returned on the morrow to Florence, under her cousin's escort, and Ralph Touchett, though usually restive under railway discipline, thought very well of the successive hours passed in the train that hurried his companion away from the city, now distinguished by Gilbert Osmond's preference hours that were to form the first stage in a larger scheme of travel. Miss Stackpole had remained behind. She was planning a little trip to Naples, to be carried out with Mr. Bantling's aid.
Isabel was to have 3 days in Florence before the 4th of June, the date of Mrs. Touchett's departure, and she determined to devote the last of these to her promise to call on Pansy Osmond. Her plan, however, seemed for a moment likely to modify itself in deference to an idea of Madame Merle's. This lady was still at Casa Touchett, but she too was on the point of leaving Florence, her next station being an ancient castle in the mountains of Tuscany, the residence of a noble family of that country, whose acquaintance, she had known them, as she said, forever, seemed to Isabel, in the light of certain photographs of their immense crenellated dwelling which her friend was able to show her, a precious privilege. She mentioned to this fortunate woman that Mr. Osmond had asked her to take a look at his daughter, but didn't mention that he had also made her a declaration of love. "Ah, comme cela c'est trouve," Madame Merle exclaimed. "I myself have been thinking it would be a kindness to pay the child a little visit before I go off." "We can go together then," Isabel reasonably said, reasonably because the proposal was not uttered in the spirit of enthusiasm. She had prefigured her small pilgrimages made in solitude, she should like it better so. She was nevertheless prepared to sacrifice this mystic sentiment to her great consideration for her friend. That personage finally meditated. "After all, why should we both go, having, each of us, so much to do during these last hours?" "Very good, I can easily go alone." "I don't know about your going alone to the house of a handsome bachelor. He has been married but so long ago." Isabel stared. "When Mr. Osmond's away, what does it matter?" "They don't know he's away, you see."
"They? Whom do you mean?"
"Everyone. But perhaps it doesn't signify."
"If you are going, why shouldn't I?" Isabel asked.
"Because I am an old frump and you're a beautiful young woman."
"Granting all that, you've not promised."
"How much you think of your promises?" said the elder woman in mild mockery.
"I think a great deal of my promises. Does that surprise you?"
"You're right," Madame Merle audibly reflected. "I really think you wish to be kind to the child."
"I wish very much to be kind to her."
"Go and see her then, no one will be the wiser. And tell her I'd have come if you hadn't. Or rather," Madame Merle added, "don't tell her. She won't care." As Isabel drove, in the publicity of an open vehicle, along the winding way which led to Mr. Osmond's hilltop, she wondered what her friend had meant by no one's being the wiser. Once in a while, at large intervals, this lady, whose voyaging discretion, as a general thing, was rather of the open sea than of the risky channel, dropped a remark of ambiguous quality, struck a note that sounded false. What cared Isabel Archer for the vulgar judgments of obscure people? And did Madame Merle suppose that she was capable of doing a thing at all if it had to be sneakingly done? Of course not, she must have meant something else, something which in the press of the hours that preceded her departure she had not had time to explain. Isabel would return to this someday, there were sorts of things as to which she liked to be clear. She heard Pansy strumming at the piano in another place as she herself was ushered into Mr. Osmond's drawing room. The little girl was practicing, and Isabel was pleased to think she performed this duty with rigor. She immediately came in, smoothing down her frock, and did the honors of her father's house with a wide-eyed earnestness of courtesy. Isabel sat there half an hour, and Pansy rose to the occasion as the small, winged fairy in the pantomime soars by the aid of the dissimulated wire, not chattering, but conversing, and showing the same respectful interest in Isabel's affairs that Isabel was so good as to take in hers. Isabel wondered at her, she had never had so directly presented to her nose the white flower of cultivated sweetness. How well the child had been taught, said our admiring young woman, how prettily she had been directed and fashioned, and yet how simple, how natural, how innocent she had been kept. Isabel was fond, ever, of the question of character and quality, of sounding, as who should say, the deep personal mystery, and it had pleased her, up to this time, to be in doubt as to whether this tender slip were not really all-knowing. Was the extremity of her candor but the perfection of self-consciousness? Was it put on to please her father's visitor, or was it the direct expression of an unspotted nature? The hour that Isabel spent in Mr. Osmond's beautiful empty, dusky rooms, the windows had been half-darkened, to keep out the heat, and here and there, through an easy crevice, the splendid summer day peeped in, lighting a gleam of faded color or tarnished gilt in the rich gloom. Her interview with the daughter of the house, I say, effectually settled this question. Pansy was really a blank page, a pure white surface, successfully kept so. She had neither art, nor guile, nor temper, nor talent, only two or three small exquisite instincts, for knowing a friend, for avoiding a mistake, for taking care of an old toy or a new frock. Yet to be so tender was to be touching withal, and she could be felt as an easy victim of fate. She would have no will, no power to resist, no sense of her own importance. She would easily be mystified, easily crushed. Her force would be all in knowing when and where to cling. She moved about the place with her visitor, who had asked leave to walk through the other rooms again, where Pansy gave her judgment on several works of art. She spoke of her prospects, her occupations, her father's intentions. She was not egotistical, but felt the propriety of supplying the information so distinguished a guest would naturally expect. "Please tell me," she said, "did Papa, in Rome, go to see Madame Catherine? He told me he would if he had time." "Perhaps he had not time. Papa likes a great deal of time. He wished to speak about my education. It isn't finished yet, you know. I don't know what they can do with me more, but it appears it's far from finished. Papa told me one day he thought he would finish it himself. For the last year or two, at the convent, the masters that teach the tall girls are so very dear. Papa's not rich, and I should be very sorry if he were to pay much money for me, because I don't think I'm worth it. I don't learn quickly enough, and I have no memory. For what I'm told, yes, especially when it's pleasant, but not for what I learn in a book. There was a young girl who was my best friend, and they took her away from the convent, when she was 14, to make how do you say it in English? To make a dot. You don't say it in English? I hope it isn't wrong. I only mean they wish to keep the money to marry her. I don't know whether it is for that Papa wishes to keep the money to marry me. It costs so much to marry." Pansy went on with a sigh, "I think Papa might make that economy. At any rate, I'm too young to think about it yet, and I don't care for any gentleman, I mean for any but him. If he were not my Papa, I should like to marry him. I would rather be his daughter than the wife of some strange person. I miss him very much, but not so much as you might think, for I've been so much away from him. Papa has always been principally for holidays. I miss Madame Catherine almost more, but you must not tell him that. You shall not see him again? I'm very sorry, and he'll be sorry too. Of everyone who comes here, I like you the best. That's not a great compliment, for there are not many people. It was very kind of you to come today so far from your house, for I'm really as yet only a child. Oh, yes, I've only the occupations of a child." "When did you give them up, the occupations of a child?" "I should like to know how old you are, but I don't know whether it's right to ask. At the convent they told us that we must never ask the age. I don't like to do anything that's not expected. It looks as if one had not been properly taught. I should never like to be taken by surprise. Papa left directions for everything. I go to bed very early. When the sun goes off that side, I go into the garden. Papa left strict orders that I was not to get scorched. I always enjoy the view, the mountains are so graceful. In Rome, from the convent, we saw nothing but roofs and bell towers. I practice 3 hours. I don't play very well. You play yourself? I wish very much you'd play something for me. Papa has the idea that I should hear good music. Madame Merle has played for me several times. That's what I like best about Madame Merle. She has great facility. I shall never have facility. And I've no voice, just a small sound like the squeak of a slate pencil making flourishes." Isabel gratified this respectful wish, drew off her gloves and sat down to the piano, while Pansy, standing beside her, watched her white hands move quickly over the keys. When she stopped, she kissed the child goodbye, held her close, looked at her long. "Be very good," she said, "give pleasure to your father." "I think that's what I live for," Pansy answered. "He has not much pleasure, he's rather a sad man." Isabel listened to this assertion with an interest which she felt it almost a torment to be obliged to conceal. It was her pride that obliged her, and a certain sense of decency. There were still other things in her head which she felt a strong impulse, instantly checked, to say to Pansy about her father. There were things it would have given her pleasure to hear the child, to make the child, say. But she no sooner became conscious of these things than her imagination was hushed with horror at the idea of taking advantage of the little girl. It was of this she would have accused herself, and of exhaling into that air where he might still have a subtle sense for it any breath of her charmed state. She had come, but she had stayed only an hour. She rose quickly from the music stool. Even then, however, she lingered a moment, still holding her small companion, drawing the child's sweet slimness closer and looking down at her almost in envy. She was obliged to confess it to herself. She would have taken a passionate pleasure in talking of Gilbert Osmond to this innocent, diminutive creature who was so near him. But she said no other word. She only kissed Pansy once again. They went together through the vestibule, to the door that opened on the court, and there her young hostess stopped, looking rather wistfully beyond. "I may go no further.
I promised Papa not to pass this door. You're right to obey him, he'll never ask you anything unreasonable.
I shall always obey him. But when will you come again?
Not for a long time, I'm afraid.
As soon as you can, I hope.
I'm only a little girl, said Pansy, but I shall always expect you. And the small figure stood in the high, dark doorway, watching Isabel cross the clear, gray court and disappear into the brightness beyond the big portone, which gave a wider dazzle as it opened.
Chapter 31. Isabel came back to Florence, but only after several months, an interval sufficiently replete with incident. It is not, however, during this interval that we are closely concerned with her. Our attention is engaged again on a certain day in the late springtime, shortly after her return to Palazzo Crescentini and a year from the date of the incidents just narrated. She was alone on this occasion, in one of the smaller of the numerous rooms devoted by Mrs. Touchett to social uses, and there was that in her expression and attitude which would have suggested that she was expecting a visitor. The tall window was open, and though its green shutters were partly drawn, the bright air of the garden had come in through a broad interstice and filled the room with warmth and perfume. Our young woman stood near it for some time, her hands clasped behind her. She gazed abroad with the vagueness of unrest. Too troubled for attention, she moved in a vain circle. Yet it could not be in her thought to catch a glimpse of her visitor before he should pass into the house, since the entrance to the palace was not through the garden, in which stillness and privacy always reigned. She wished rather to forestall his arrival by a process of conjecture, and to judge by the expression of her face, this attempt gave her plenty to do. Grave she found herself, and positively more weighted, as by the experience of the lapse of the year she had spent in seeing the world. She had ranged, she would have said, through space and surveyed much of mankind, and was therefore now, in her own eyes, a very different person from the frivolous young woman from Albany who had begun to take the measure of Europe on the lawn at Gardencourt a couple of years before. She flattered herself she had harvested wisdom and learned a great deal more of life than this light-minded creature had even suspected. If her thoughts just now had inclined themselves to retrospect, instead of fluttering their wings nervously about the present, they would have evoked a multitude of interesting pictures. These pictures would have been both landscapes and figure pieces, the latter, however, would have been the more numerous. With several of the images that might have been projected on such a field we are already acquainted. There would be, for instance, the conciliatory Lily, our heroine's sister and Edmund Ludlow's wife, who had come out from New York to spend 5 months with her relative. She had left her husband behind her, but had brought her children, to whom Isabel now played with equal munificence and tenderness the part of maiden aunt. Mr. Ludlow, toward the last, had been able to snatch a few weeks from his forensic triumphs and, crossing the ocean with extreme rapidity, had spent a month with the two ladies in Paris before taking his wife home. The little Ludlows had not yet, even from the American point of view, reached the proper tourist age, so that while her sister was with her, Isabel had confined her movements to a narrow circle. Lily and the babies had joined her in Switzerland in the month of July, and they had spent a summer of fine weather in an alpine valley where the flowers were thick and the meadows and the shade of great chestnuts made a resting place for such upward wanderings as might be undertaken by ladies and children on warm afternoons. They had afterwards reached the French capital, which was worshipped, and with costly ceremonies, by Lily, but thought of as noisily vacant by Isabel, who in these days made use of her memory of Rome as she might have done, in a hot and crowded room, of a phial of something pungent hidden in her handkerchief. Mrs. Ludlow sacrificed, as I say, to Paris, yet had doubts and wonderments not allayed at that altar, and after her husband had joined her found further chagrin in his failure to throw himself into these speculations. They all had Isabel for subject, but Edmund Ludlow, as he had always done before, declined to be surprised, or distressed, or mystified, or elated, at anything his sister-in-law might have done or have failed to do. Mrs. Ludlow's mental emotions were sufficiently various. At one moment she thought it would be so natural for that young woman to come home and take a house in New York, the Rossiters, for instance, which had an elegant conservatory and was just round the corner from her own. At another she couldn't conceal her surprise at the girl's not marrying some member of one of the great aristocracies. On the whole, as I have said, she had fallen from high communion with the probabilities. She had taken more satisfaction in Isabel's accession of fortune than if the money had been left to herself. It had seemed to her to offer just the proper setting for her sister's slightly meager, but scarce the less eminent figure. Isabel had developed less, however, than Lily had thought likely development, to Lily's understanding, being somehow mysteriously connected with morning calls and evening parties. Intellectually, doubtless, she had made immense strides,
but she appeared to have achieved few of those social conquests of which Mrs. Ludlow had expected to admire the trophies. Lily's conception of such achievements was extremely vague, but this was exactly what she had expected of Isabel to give it form and body. Isabel could have done as well as she had done in New York, and Mrs. Ludlow appealed to her husband to know whether there was any privilege she enjoyed in Europe which the society of that city might not offer her. We know ourselves that Isabel had made conquests whether inferior or not to those she might have effected in her native land. It would be a delicate matter to decide, and it is not altogether with a feeling of complacency that I again mention that she had not rendered these honorable victories public. She had not told her sister the history of Lord Warburton, nor had she given her a hint of Mr. Osmond's state of mind, and she had had no better reason for her silence than that she didn't wish to speak. It was more romantic to say nothing, and, drinking deep, in secret, of romance, she was as little disposed to ask poor Lily's advice as she would have been to close that rare volume forever. But Lily knew nothing of these discriminations, and could only pronounce her sister's career a strange anticlimax, an impression confirmed by the fact that Isabel's silence about Mr. Osmond, for instance, was in direct proportion to the frequency with which he occupied her thoughts. As this happened very often, it sometimes appeared to Mrs. Ludlow that she had lost her courage. So uncanny a result of so exhilarating an incident as inheriting a fortune was of course perplexing to the cheerful Lily. It added to her general sense that Isabel was not at all like other people. Our young lady's courage, however, might have been taken as reaching its height after her relations had gone home. She could imagine braver things than spending the winter in Paris. Paris had sides by which it so resembled New York. Paris was like smart, neat prose, and her close correspondence with Madame Merle did much to stimulate such flights. She had never had a keener sense of freedom, of the absolute boldness and wantonness of liberty, than when she turned away from the platform at the Euston station on one of the last days of November, after the departure of the train that was to convey poor Lily, her husband and her children to their ship at Liverpool. It had been good for her to regale, she was very conscious of that, she was very observant, as we know, of what was good for her, and her effort was constantly to find something that was good enough. To profit by the present advantage till the latest moment she had made the journey from Paris with the unenvied travelers. She would have accompanied them to Liverpool as well, only Edmund Ludlow had asked her, as a favor, not to do so. It made Lily so fidgety and she asked such impossible questions. Isabel watched the train move away, she kissed her hand to the elder of her small nephews, a demonstrative child who leaned dangerously far out of the window of the carriage and made separation an occasion of violent hilarity. And then she walked back into the foggy London street. The world lay before her, she could do whatever she chose. There was a deep thrill in it all, but for the present her choice was tolerably discreet. She chose simply to walk back from Euston Square to her hotel. The early dusk of a November afternoon had already closed in, the street lamps, in the thick, brown air, looked weak and red. Our heroine was unattended and Euston Square was a long way from Piccadilly. But Isabel performed the journey with a positive enjoyment of its dangers and lost her way almost on purpose, in order to get more sensations, so that she was disappointed when an obliging policeman easily set her right again. She was so fond of the spectacle of human life that she enjoyed even the aspect of gathering dusk in the London streets, the moving crowds, the hurrying cabs, the lighted shops, the flaring stalls, the dark, shining dampness of everything. That evening, at her hotel, she wrote to Madame Merle that she should start in a day or two for Rome. She made her way down to Rome without touching at Florence, having gone first to Venice and then proceeded southward by Ancona. She accomplished this journey without other assistance than that of her servant, for her natural protectors were not now on the ground. Ralph Touchett was spending the winter at Corfu, and Miss Stackpole, in the September previous, had been recalled to America by a telegram from the Interviewer. This journal offered its brilliant correspondent a fresher field for her genius than the mouldering cities of Europe, and Henrietta was cheered on her way by a promise from Mr. Bantling that he would soon come over to see her. Isabel wrote to Mrs. Touchett to apologize for not presenting herself just yet in Florence, and her aunt replied characteristically enough. Apologies, Mrs. Touchett intimated, were of no more use to her than bubbles, and she herself never dealt in such articles. One either did the thing or one didn't. And what one would have done belonged to the sphere of the irrelevant, like the idea of a future life or of the origin of things. Her letter was frank, but, a rare case with Mrs. Touchett, not so frank as it pretended. She easily forgave her niece for not stopping at Florence, because she took it for a sign that Gilbert Osmond was less in question there than formerly. She watched, of course, to see if he would now find a pretext for going to Rome, and derived some comfort from learning that he had not been guilty of an absence. Isabel, on her side, had not been a fortnight in Rome before she proposed to Madame Merle that they should make a little pilgrimage to the east. Madame Merle remarked that her friend was restless, but she added that she herself had always been consumed with the desire to visit Athens and Constantinople. The two ladies accordingly embarked on this expedition, and spent 3 months in Greece, in Turkey, in Egypt. Isabel found much to interest her in these countries, though Madame Merle continued to remark that even among the most classic sights, the scenes most calculated to suggest repose and reflection, a certain incoherence prevailed in her. Isabel traveled rapidly and recklessly, she was like a thirsty person draining cup after cup. Madame Merle meanwhile, as lady-in-waiting to a princess circulating incognita, panted a little in her rear. It was on Isabel's invitation she had come, and she imparted all due dignity to the girl's uncountenanced state. She played her part with the tact that might have been expected of her, effacing herself and accepting the position of a companion whose expenses were profusely paid. The situation, however, had no hardships, and people who met this reserved though striking pair on their travels would not have been able to tell you which was patroness and which client. To say that Madame Merle improved on acquaintance states meagerly the impression she made on her friend, who had found her from the first so ample and so easy. At the end of an intimacy of 3 months, Isabel felt she knew her better, her character had revealed itself, and the admirable woman had also at last redeemed her promise of relating her history from her own point of view, a consummation the more desirable as Isabel had already heard it related from the point of view of others. This history was so sad a one, in so far as it concerned the late M. Merle, a positive adventurer, she might say, though originally so plausible, who had taken advantage, years before, of her youth and of an inexperience in which doubtless those who knew her only now would find it difficult to believe. It abounded so in startling and lamentable incidents that her companion wondered a person so improvvi could have kept so much of her freshness, her interest in life. Into this freshness of Madame Merle she obtained a considerable insight, she seemed to see it as professional, as slightly mechanical, carried about in its case like the fiddle of the virtuoso, or blanketed and bridled like the favorite of the jockey. She liked her as much as ever, but there was a corner of the curtain that never was lifted. It was as if she had remained after all something of a public performer, condemned to emerge only in character and in costume. She had once said that she came from a distance, that she belonged to the old, old world, and Isabel never lost the impression that she was the product of a different moral or social clime from her own, that she had grown up under other stars. She believed then that at bottom she had a different morality. Of course the morality of civilized persons has always much in common, but our young woman had a sense in her of values gone wrong or, as they said at the shops, marked down. She considered, with the presumption of youth, that a morality differing from her own must be inferior to it, and this conviction was an aid to detecting an occasional flash of cruelty, an occasional lapse from candor, in the conversation of a person who had raised delicate kindness to an art and whose pride was too high for the narrow ways of deception. Her conception of human motives might, in certain lights, have been acquired at the court of some kingdom in decadence, and there were several in her list of which our heroine had not even heard. She had not heard of everything, that was very plain, and there were evidently things in the world of which it was not advantageous to hear. She had once or twice had a positive scare, since it so affected her to have to exclaim, of her friend, "Heaven forgive her, she doesn't understand me." Absurd as it may seem, this discovery operated as a shock, left her with a vague dismay in which there was even an element of foreboding. The dismay of course subsided, in the light of some sudden proof of Madame Merle's remarkable intelligence, but it stood for a high watermark in the ebb and flow of confidence. Madame Merle had once declared her belief that when a friendship ceases to grow it immediately begins to decline, there being no point of equilibrium between liking more and liking less. A stationary affection, in other words, was impossible, it must move one way or the other. However that might be, the girl had in these days a thousand uses for her sense of the romantic, which was more active than it had ever been. I do not allude to the impulse it received as she gazed at the pyramids in the course of an excursion from Cairo, or as she stood among the broken columns of the Acropolis and fixed her eyes upon the point designated to her as the Strait of Salamis, deep and memorable as these emotions had remained. She came back by the last of March from Egypt and Greece and made another stay in Rome. A few days after her arrival Gilbert Osmond descended from Florence and remained 3 weeks, during which the fact of her being with his old friend Madame Merle, in whose house she had gone to lodge, made it virtually inevitable that he should see her every day. When the last of April came she wrote to Mrs. Touchett that she should now rejoice to accept an invitation given long before, and went to pay a visit at Palazzo Crescentini, Madame Merle on this occasion remaining in Rome. She found her aunt alone, her cousin was still at Corfu. Ralph, however, was expected in Florence from day to day, and Isabel, who had not seen him for upwards of a year, was prepared to give him the most affectionate welcome. Chapter 32. It was not of him, nevertheless, that she was thinking while she stood at the window near which we found her a while ago, and it was not of any of the matters I have rapidly sketched. She was not turned to the past, but to the immediate, impending hour. She had reason to expect a scene, and she was not fond of scenes. She was not asking herself what she should say to her visitor, this question had already been answered. What he would say to her, that was the interesting issue. It could be nothing in the least soothing, she had warned for this, and the conviction doubtless showed in the cloud on her brow. For the rest, however, all clearness reigned in her, she had put away her mourning and she walked in no small shimmering splendor. She only felt older ever so much, and as if she were worth more for it, like some curious piece in an antiquary's collection. She was not at any rate left indefinitely to her apprehensions, for a servant at last stood before her with a card on his tray. "Let the gentleman come in," she said, and continued to gaze out of the window after the footman had retired. It was only when she had heard the door close behind the person who presently entered that she looked round. Caspar Goodwood stood and received a moment, from head to foot, the bright, dry gaze with which she rather withheld than offered a greeting. Whether his sense of maturity had kept pace with Isabel's we shall perhaps presently ascertain, let me say meanwhile that to her critical glance he showed nothing of the injury of time. Straight, strong and hard, there was nothing in his appearance that spoke positively either of youth or of age, if he had neither innocence nor weakness, so he had no practical philosophy. His jaw showed the same voluntary cast as in earlier days, but a crisis like the present had in it of course something grim. He had the air of a man who had traveled hard. He said nothing at first, as if he had been out of breath. This gave Isabel time to make a reflection, poor fellow, what great things he's capable of, and what a pity he should waste so dreadfully his splendid force. What a pity too that one can't satisfy everybody. It gave her time to do more to say at the end of a minute, "I can't tell you how I hoped you wouldn't come." "I've no doubt of that." And he looked about him for a seat. Not only had he come, but he meant to settle. "You must be very tired," said Isabel, seating herself, and generously, as she thought, to give him his opportunity. "No, I'm not at all tired. Did you ever know me to be tired?" "Never, I wish I had. When did you arrive?"
"Last night, very late, in a kind of snail train they call the express. These Italian trains go at about the rate of an American funeral."
"That's in keeping. You must have felt as if you were coming to bury me." And she forced a smile of encouragement to an easy view of their situation. She had reasoned the matter well out, making it perfectly clear that she broke no faith and falsified no contract, but for all this she was afraid of her visitor. She was ashamed of her fear, but she was devoutly thankful there was nothing else to be ashamed of. He looked at her with his stiff insistence, an insistence in which there was such a want of tact, especially when the dull dark beam in his eye rested on her as a physical weight.
"No, I didn't feel that, I couldn't think of you as dead. I wish I could," he candidly declared.
"I thank you immensely. I'd rather think of you as dead than as married to another man."
"That's very selfish of you," she returned with the ardor of a real conviction. "If you're not happy yourself, others have yet a right to be."
"Very likely it's selfish, but I don't in the least mind your saying so. I don't mind anything you can say now I don't feel it. The cruelest things you could think of would be mere pinpricks. After what you've done I shall never feel anything. I mean anything but that. That I shall feel all my life." Mr. Goodwood made these detached assertions with dry deliberateness, in his hard, slow American tone, which flung no atmospheric color over propositions intrinsically crude. The tone made Isabel angry rather than touched her, but her anger perhaps was fortunate, inasmuch as it gave her a further reason for controlling herself. It was under the pressure of this control that she became, after a little, irrelevant.
"When did you leave New York?"
He threw up his head as if calculating.
17 days ago.
"You must have traveled fast in spite of your slow trains."
"I came as fast as I could. I'd have come 5 days ago if I had been able."
"It wouldn't have made any difference, Mr. Goodwood," she coldly smiled.
"Not to you, no. But to me.
You gain nothing that I see."
"That's for me to judge."
"Of course. To me it seems that you only torment yourself." And then, to change the subject, she asked him if he had seen Henrietta Stackpole. He looked as if he had not come from Boston to Florence to talk of Henrietta Stackpole, but he answered, distinctly enough, that this young lady had been with him just before he left America. She came to see you? Isabel then demanded.
Yes, she was in Boston, and she called at my office. It was the day I had got your letter.
Did you tell her? Isabel asked with a certain anxiety.
Oh no, said Casper Goodwood simply, I didn't want to do that.
She'll hear it quick enough, she hears everything.
I shall write to her, and then she'll write to me and scold me, Isabel declared, trying to smile again.
Casper, however, remained sternly grave. I guess she'll come right out, he said.
On purpose to scold me?
I don't know. She seemed to think she had not seen Europe thoroughly.
I'm glad you tell me that, Isabel said. I must prepare for her.
Mr. Goodwood fixed his eyes for a moment on the floor, then at last, raising them, does she know Mr. Osmond? He inquired.
A little. And she doesn't like him. But of course I don't marry to please Henrietta, she added. It would have been better for poor Casper if she had tried a little more to gratify Miss Stackpole, but he didn't say so, he only asked, presently, when her marriage would take place. To which she made answer that she didn't know yet. I can only say it will be soon. I've told no one but yourself and one other person, an old friend of Mr. Osmond's.
Is it a marriage your friends won't like? He demanded.
I really haven't an idea. As I say, I don't marry for my friends. He went on, making no exclamation, no comment, only asking questions, doing it quite without delicacy. Who and what then is Mr. Gilbert Osmond?
Who and what?
Nobody and nothing but a very good and very honorable man.
He's not in business, said Isabel. He's not rich, he's not known for anything in particular.
She disliked Mr. Goodwood's questions, but she said to herself that she owed it to him to satisfy him as far as possible. The satisfaction poor Casper exhibited was, however, small. He sat very upright, gazing at her. Where does he come from? Where does he belong? She had never been so little pleased with the way he said bellow. He comes from nowhere. He has spent most of his life in Italy.
You said in your letter he was American. Hasn't he a native place?
Yes, but he has forgotten it. He left it as a small boy.
Has he never gone back?
Why should he go back? Isabel asked, flushing all defensively. He has no profession.
He might have gone back for his pleasure.
Doesn't he like the United States?
He doesn't know them.
Then he's very quiet and very simple. He contents himself with Italy.
With Italy and with you, said Mr. Goodwood with gloomy plainness and no appearance of trying to make an epigram.
What has he ever done? He added abruptly.
That I should marry him?
Nothing at all, Isabel replied while her patience helped itself by turning a little to hardness. If he had done great things, would you forgive me any better?
Give me up, Mr. Goodwood, I'm marrying a perfect nonentity.
Don't try to take an interest in him.
You can't.
I can't appreciate him, that's what you mean.
And you don't mean in the least that he's a perfect nonentity.
You think he's grand, you think he's great, though no one else thinks so.
Isabel's color deepened, she felt this really acute of her companion, and it was certainly a proof of the aid that passion might render perceptions she had never taken for fine.
Why do you always come back to what others think?
I can't discuss Mr. Osmond with you.
Of course not, said Casper reasonably. And he sat there with his air of stiff helplessness, as if not only this were true, but there were nothing else that they might discuss.
You see how little you gain, she accordingly broke out, how little comfort or satisfaction I can give you.
I didn't expect you to give me much.
I don't understand then why you came.
I came because I wanted to see you once more, even just as you are.
I appreciate that, but if you had waited a while, sooner or later we should have been sure to meet, and our meeting would have been pleasanter for each of us than this.
Waited till after you're married?
That's just what I didn't want to do.
You'll be different then.
Not very.
I shall still be a great friend of yours.
You'll see.
That will make it all the worse, said Mr. Goodwood grimly.
Ah, you're unaccommodating.
I can't promise to dislike you in order to help you to resign yourself.
I shouldn't care if you did.
Isabel got up with a movement of repressed impatience and walked to the window, where she remained a moment looking out. When she turned round, her visitor was still motionless in his place. She came toward him again and stopped, resting her hand on the back of the chair she had just quitted.
Do you mean you came simply to look at me?
That's better for you perhaps than for me.
I wish to hear the sound of your voice, he said.
You've heard it, and you see it says nothing very sweet.
It gives me pleasure, all the same.
And with this he got up.
She had felt pain and displeasure on receiving early that day the news he was in Florence and by her leave would come within an hour to see her. She had been vexed and distressed, though she had sent back word by his messenger that he might come when he would. She had not been better pleased when she saw him, his being there at all was so full of heavy implications. It implied things she could never assent to: rights, reproaches, remonstrance, rebuke, the expectation of making her change her purpose. These things, however, if implied, had not been expressed, and now our young lady, strangely enough, began to resent her visitor's remarkable self-control. There was a dumb misery about him that irritated her, there was a manly staying of his hand that made her heart beat faster. She felt her agitation rising, and she said to herself that she was angry in the way a woman is angry when she has been in the wrong. She was not in the wrong, she had fortunately not that bitterness to swallow, but, all the same, she wished he would denounce her a little. She had wished his visit would be short, it had no purpose, no propriety, yet now that he seemed to be turning away she felt a sudden horror of his leaving her without uttering a word that would give her an opportunity to defend herself more than she had done in writing to him a month before, in a few carefully chosen words, to announce her engagement. If she were not in the wrong, however, why should she desire to defend herself? It was an excess of generosity on Isabel's part to desire that Mr. Goodwood should be angry. And if he had not meanwhile held himself hard it might have made him so to hear the tone in which she suddenly exclaimed, as if she were accusing him of having accused her, "I've not deceived you. I was perfectly free."
"Yes, I know that," said Casper. "I gave you full warning that I'd do as I chose. You said you'd probably never marry, and you said it with such a manner that I pretty well believed it." She considered this an instant. "No one can be more surprised than myself at my present intention."
"You told me that if I heard you were engaged I was not to believe it," Casper went on. "I heard it 20 days ago from yourself, but I remembered what you had said. I thought there might be some mistake, and that's partly why I came. If you wish me to repeat it by word of mouth, that's soon done. There's no mistake whatever. I saw that as soon as I came into the room." "What good would it do you that I shouldn't marry?" she asked with a certain fierceness. "I should like it better than this. You're very selfish, as I said before. I know that. Unselfish as iron. Even iron sometimes melts. If you'll be reasonable I'll see you again."
"Don't you call me reasonable now?"
"I don't know what to say to you," she answered with sudden humility. "I shan't trouble you for a long time," the young man went on. He made a step towards the door, but he stopped. "Another reason why I came was that I wanted to hear what you would say in explanation of your having changed your mind." Her humbleness has suddenly deserted her. "In explanation? Do you think I'm bound to explain?" He gave her one of his long dumb looks. "You were very positive. I did believe it."
"So did I. Do you think I could explain if I would?"
"No, I suppose not. Well," he added, "I've done what I wished. I've seen you. How little you make of these terrible journeys," she felt the poverty of her presently replying. "If you're afraid I'm knocked up in any such way as that you may be at your ease about it." He turned away, this time in earnest, and no handshake, no sign of parting, was exchanged between them. At the door he stopped with his hand on the knob. "I shall leave Florence tomorrow," he said without a quaver.
"I'm delighted to hear it," she answered passionately. 5 minutes after he had gone out she burst into tears.
Chapter 33. Her fit of weeping, however, was soon smothered, and the signs of it had vanished when, an hour later, she broke the news to her aunt. I use this expression because she had been sure Mrs. Touchett would not be pleased. Isabel had only waited to tell her till she had seen Mr. Goodwood. She had an odd impression that it would not be honorable to make the fact public before she should have heard what Mr. Goodwood would say about it. He had said rather less than she expected, and she now had a somewhat angry sense of having lost time. But she would lose no more. She waited till Mrs. Touchett came into the drawing room before the midday breakfast, and then she began. "Aunt Lydia, I've something to tell you." Mrs. Touchett gave a little jump and looked at her almost fiercely.
"You needn't tell me, I know what it is."
"I don't know how you know."
"The same way that I know when the windows open by feeling a draft. You're going to marry that man."
"What man do you mean?" Isabel inquired with great dignity.
"Madame Merle's friend, Mr. Osmond."
"I don't know why you call him Madame Merle's friend. Is that the principal thing he is known by?"
"If he's not her friend he ought to be after what she has done for him," cried Mrs. Touchett. "I shouldn't have expected it of her, I'm disappointed."
"If you mean that Madame Merle has had anything to do with my engagement you're greatly mistaken,"
Isabel declared with a sort of ardent coldness.
You mean that your attractions were sufficient, without the gentleman's having had to be lashed up?
You're quite right. The romance, your attractions, and he would never have presumed to think of you if she hadn't put him up to it. He has a very good opinion of himself, but he was not a man to take trouble. Madame Merle took the trouble for him.
He has taken a great deal for himself, cried Isabel with a voluntary laugh.
Mrs. Touchett gave a sharp nod. I think he must, after all, to have made you like him so much.
I thought he even pleased you.
He did, at one time, and that's why I'm angry with him.
Be angry with me, not with him, said the girl.
Oh, I'm always angry with you, that's no satisfaction. Was it for this that you refused Lord Warburton?
Please don't go back to that. Why shouldn't I like Mr. Osmond, since others have done so?
Others, at their wildest moments, never wanted to marry him.
There's nothing of him, Mrs. Touchett explained.
Then he can't hurt me, said Isabel.
Do you think you're going to be happy?
No one's happy, in such doings, you should know.
I shall set the fashion then. What does one marry for?
What you will marry for, heaven only knows. People usually marry as they go into partnership to set up a house. But in your partnership you'll bring everything.
Is it that Mr. Osmond isn't rich?
Is that what you're talking about? Isabel asked.
He has no money, he has no name, he has no importance. I value such things and I have the courage to say it, I think they're very precious. Many other people think the same, and they show it. But they give some other reason.
Isabel hesitated a little.
I think I value everything that's valuable. I care very much for money, and that's why I wish Mr. Osmond to have a little.
Give it to him then, but marry someone else.
His name's good enough for me, the girl went on. It's a very pretty name. Have I such a fine one myself?
All the more reason you should improve on it. There are only a dozen American names. Do you marry him out of charity?
It was my duty to tell you, Aunt Lydia, but I don't think it's my duty to explain to you. Even if it were, I shouldn't be able. So please don't remonstrate. In talking about it, you have me at a disadvantage. I can't talk about it.
I don't remonstrate, I simply answer you. I must give some sign of intelligence. I saw it coming, and I said nothing. I never meddle.
You never do, and I'm greatly obliged to you. You've been very considerate.
It was not considerate, it was convenient, said Mrs. Touchett. But I shall talk to Madame Merle.
I don't see why you keep bringing her in. She has been a very good friend to me.
Possibly, but she has been a poor one to me.
What has she done to you?
She has deceived me. She had as good as promised me to prevent your engagement.
She couldn't have prevented it.
She can do anything, that's what I've always liked her for. I knew she could play any part, but I understood that she played them one by one. I didn't understand that she would play two at the same time.
I don't know what part she may have played to you, Isabel said, that's between yourselves. To me she has been honest and kind and devoted.
Devoted, of course, she wished you to marry her candidate. She told me she was watching you only in order to interpose.
She said that to please you, the girl answered, conscious, however, of the inadequacy of the explanation.
To please me by deceiving me? She knows me better. Am I pleased today?
I don't think you're ever much pleased, Isabel was obliged to reply. If Madame Merle knew you would learn the truth, what had she to gain by insincerity?
She gained time, as you see. While I waited for her to interfere, you were marching away, and she was really beating the drum.
That's very well. But by your own admission you saw I was marching, and even if she had given the alarm you wouldn't have tried to stop me.
No, but someone else would.
Whom do you mean?
Isabel asked, looking very hard at her aunt.
Mrs. Touchett's little bright eyes, active as they usually were, sustained her gaze rather than returned it.
Would you have listened to Ralph?
Not if he had abused Mr. Osmond.
Ralph doesn't abuse people. You know that perfectly. He cares very much for you.
I know he does, said Isabel, and I shall feel the value of it now, for he knows that whatever I do with reason.
He never believed you would do this. I told him you were capable of it, and he argued the other way.
He did it for the sake of argument, the girl smiled.
You don't accuse him of having deceived you, why should you accuse Madame Merle?
He never pretended he'd prevent it.
I'm glad of that, cried Isabel gaily. I wish very much, she presently added, that when he comes you'd tell him first of my engagement.
Of course I'll mention it, said Mrs. Touchett. I shall say nothing more to you about it, but I give you notice I shall talk to others.
That's as you please. I only meant that it's rather better the announcement should come from you than from me.
I quite agree with you, it's much more proper. And on this the aunt and the niece went to breakfast, where Mrs. Touchett, as good as her word, made no allusion to Gilbert Osmond. After an interval of silence, however, she asked her companion from whom she had received a visit an hour before.
From an old friend, an American gentleman, Isabel said with a color in her cheek.
An American gentleman, of course. It's only an American gentleman who calls at 10 o'clock in the morning.
It was 10:30, he was in a great hurry, he goes away this evening.
Couldn't he have come yesterday, at the usual time?
He only arrived last night.
He spends but 24 hours in Florence?
Mrs. Touchett cried. He's an American gentleman truly.
He is indeed, said Isabel, thinking with perverse admiration of what Caspar Goodwood had done for her.
2 days afterward Ralph arrived, but though Isabel was sure that Mrs. Touchett had lost no time in imparting to him the great fact, he showed at first no open knowledge of it. Their prompted talk was naturally of his health. Isabel had many questions to ask about Corfu. She had been shocked by his appearance when he came into the room, she had forgotten how ill he looked. In spite of Corfu he looked very ill today, and she wondered if he were really worse or if she were simply disaccustomed to living with an invalid. Poor Ralph made no nearer approach to conventional beauty as he advanced in life, and the now apparently complete loss of his health had done little to mitigate the natural oddity of his person. Blighted and battered, but still responsive and still ironic, his face was like a lighted lantern patched with paper and unsteadily held, his thin whisker languished upon a lean cheek, the exorbitant curve of his nose defined itself more sharply. Lean he was altogether, lean and long and loose-jointed, an accidental cohesion of relaxed angles. His brown velvet jacket had become perennial, his hands had fixed themselves in his pockets, he shambled and stumbled and shuffled in a manner that denoted great physical helplessness. It was perhaps this whimsical gait that helped to mark his character more than ever as that of the humorous invalid, the invalid for whom even his own disabilities are part of the general joke. They might well indeed with Ralph have been the chief cause of the want of seriousness marking his view of a world in which the reason for his own continued presence was past finding out. Isabel had grown fond of his ugliness, his awkwardness had become dear to her. They had been sweetened by association, they struck her as the very terms on which it had been given him to be charming. He was so charming that her sense of his being ill had hitherto had a sort of comfort in it, the state of his health had seemed not a limitation, but a kind of intellectual advantage. It absolved him from all professional and official emotions and left him the luxury of being exclusively personal. The personality so resulting was delightful, he had remained proof against the staleness of disease, he had had to consent to be deplorably ill, yet had somehow escaped being formally sick. Such had been the girl's impression of her cousin, and when she had pitied him it was only on reflection. As she reflected a good deal she had allowed him a certain amount of compassion, but she always had a dread of wasting that essence, a precious article, worth more to the giver than to anyone else. Now, however, it took no great sensibility to feel that poor Ralph's tenure of life was less elastic than it should be. He was a bright, free, generous spirit, he had all the illumination of wisdom and none of its pedantry, and yet he was distressfully dying. Isabel noted afresh that life was certainly hard for some people, and she felt a delicate glow of shame as she thought how easy it now promised to become for herself. She was prepared to learn that Ralph was not pleased with her engagement, but she was not prepared, in spite of her affection for him, to let this fact spoil the situation. She was not even prepared, or so she thought, to resent his want of sympathy, for it would be his privilege, it would be indeed his natural line to find fault with any step she might take toward marriage. One's cousin always pretended to hate one's husband, that was traditional, classical, it was a part of one's cousin's always pretending to adore one. Ralph was nothing if not critical, and though she would certainly, other things being equal, have been as glad to marry to please him as to please anyone, it would be absurd to regard as important that her choice should square with his views. What were his views after all? He had pretended to believe she had better have married Lord Warburton, but this was only because she had refused that excellent man. If she had accepted him, Ralph would certainly have taken another tone, he always took the opposite. You could criticize any marriage. It was the essence of a marriage to be open to criticism. How well she herself, should she only give her mind to it, might criticize this union of her own. She had other employment, however, and Ralph was welcome to relieve her of the care. Isabel was prepared to be most patient and most indulgent. He must have seen that, and this made it the more odd he should say nothing.
After 3 days had elapsed without his speaking, our young woman wearied of waiting, dislike it as he would, he might at least go through the form. We, who know more about poor Ralph than his cousin, may easily believe that during the hours that followed his arrival at Palazzo Crescentini he had privately gone through many forms. His mother had literally greeted him with the great news, which had been even more sensibly chilling than Mrs. Touchett's maternal kiss. Ralph was shocked and humiliated. His calculations had been false and the person in the world in whom he was most interested was lost. He drifted about the house like a rudderless vessel in a rocky stream, or sat in the garden of the palace on a great cane chair, his long legs extended, his head thrown back and his hat pulled over his eyes. He felt cold about the heart. He had never liked anything less. What could he do? What could he say? If the girl were irreclaimable, could he pretend to like it? To attempt to reclaim her was permissible only if the attempt should succeed. To try to persuade her of anything sordid or sinister in the man to whose deep heart she had succumbed would be decently discreet only in the event of her being persuaded. Otherwise he should simply have damned himself. It cost him an equal effort to speak his thought and to dissemble. He could neither assent with sincerity nor protest with hope. Meanwhile he knew, or rather he supposed, that the affianced pair were daily renewing their mutual vows. Osmond at this moment showed himself little at Palazzo Crescentini, but Isabel met him every day elsewhere, as she was free to do after their engagement had been made public. She had taken a carriage by the month, so as not to be indebted to her aunt for the means of pursuing a course of which Mrs. Touchett disapproved, and she drove in the morning to the Cascine. This suburban wilderness, during the early hours, was void of all intruders, and our young lady, joined by her lover in its quietest part, strolled with him a while through the grey Italian shade and listened to the nightingales. Chapter 34. One morning, on her return from her drive, some half hour before luncheon, she quitted her vehicle in the court of the palace and, instead of ascending the great staircase, crossed the court, passed beneath another archway and entered the garden. A sweeter spot at this moment could not have been imagined. The stillness of noontide hung over it, and the warm shade, enclosed and still, made bowers like spacious caves. Ralph was sitting there in the clear gloom, at the base of a statue of Terpsichore, a dancing nymph with taper fingers and inflated draperies in the manner of Bernini. The extreme relaxation of his attitude suggested at first to Isabel that he was asleep. Her light footstep on the grass had not roused him, and before turning away she stood for a moment looking at him. During this instant he opened his eyes, upon which he sat down on a rustic chair that matched with his own. Though in her irritation she had accused him of indifference, she was not blind to the fact that he had visibly had something to brood over. But she had explained his air of absence partly by the languor of his increased weakness, partly by worries connected with the property inherited from his father, the fruit of eccentric arrangements of which Mrs. Touchett disapproved and which, as she had told Isabel, now encountered opposition from the other partners in the bank. He ought to have gone to England, his mother said, instead of coming to Florence. He had not been there for months, and took no more interest in the bank than in the state of Patagonia. "I'm sorry I waked you," Isabel said. "You look too tired." "I feel too tired. But I was not asleep. I was thinking of you." "Are you tired of that?"
"Very much so. It leads to nothing. The road's long and I never arrive."
"What do you wish to arrive at?" she put to him, closing her parasol. "At the point of expressing to myself properly what I think of your engagement."
"Don't think too much of it," she lightly returned.
"Do you mean that it's none of my business?"
"Beyond a certain point, yes. That's the point I want to fix. I had an idea you may have found me wanting in good manners. I've never congratulated you."
"Of course I've noticed that. I wondered why you were silent."
"There have been a good many reasons. I'll tell you now," Ralph said. He pulled off his hat and laid it on the ground, then he sat looking at her. He leaned back under the protection of Bernini, his head against his marble pedestal, his arms dropped on either side of him, his hands laid upon the rests of his wide chair. He looked awkward, uncomfortable. He hesitated long. Isabel said nothing. When people were embarrassed she was usually sorry for them, but she was determined not to help Ralph to utter a word that should not be to the honor of her high decision. "I think I've hardly got over my surprise," he went on at last. "You were the last person I expected to see caught."
"I don't know why you call it caught."
"Because you're going to be put into a cage."
"If I like my cage, that needn't trouble you," she answered.
"That's what I wonder at, that's what I've been thinking of. If you've been thinking, you may imagine how I've thought. I'm satisfied that I'm doing well."
"You must have changed immensely. A year ago you valued your liberty beyond everything. You wanted only to see life."
"I've seen it," said Isabel.
It doesn't look to me now, I admit, such an inviting expanse.
I don't pretend it is, only I had an idea that you took a genial view of it and wanted to survey the whole field.
I've seen that one can't do anything so general. One must choose a corner and cultivate that.
That's what I think. And one must choose as good a corner as possible.
I had no idea, all winter, while I read your delightful letters, that you were choosing.
You said nothing about it, and your silence put me off my guard. It was not a matter I was likely to write to you about. Besides, I knew nothing of the future. It has all come lately. If you had been on your guard, however, Isabel asked, what would you have done?
I should have said wait a little longer.
Wait for what?
Well, for a little more light, said Ralph with rather an absurd smile, while his hands found their way into his pockets.
Where should my light have come from?
From you?
I might have struck a spark or two.
Isabel had drawn off her gloves, she smoothed them out as they lay upon her knee. The mildness of this movement was accidental, for her expression was not conciliatory.
You're beating about the bush, Ralph. You wish to say you don't like Mr. Osmond, and yet you're afraid.
Willing to wound and yet afraid to strike?
I'm willing to wound him, yes, but not to wound you.
I'm afraid of you, not of him. If you marry him, it won't be a fortunate way for me to have spoken.
If I marry him, have you had any expectation of dissuading me?
Of course that seems to you too fatuous.
No, said Isabel after a little, it seems to me too touching.
That's the same thing. It makes me so ridiculous that you pity me.
She stroked out her long gloves again. I know you've a great affection for me. I can't get rid of that.
For heaven's sake, don't try. Keep that well in sight. It will convince you how intensely I want you to do well.
And how little you trust me.
There was a moment's silence, the warm noontide seemed to listen.
I trust you, but I don't trust him, said Ralph.
She raised her eyes and gave him a wide, deep look.
You've said it now, and I'm glad you've made it so clear. But you'll suffer by it.
Not if you're just.
I'm very just, said Isabel. What better proof of it can there be than that I'm not angry with you? I don't know what's the matter with me, but I'm not. I was when you began, but it has passed away. Perhaps I ought to be angry, but Mr. Osmond wouldn't think so. He wants me to know everything, that's what I like him for.
You've nothing to gain, I know that. I've never been so nice to you, as a girl, that you should have much reason for wishing me to remain one.